funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very pleased to have as my guest Azar Nafisi, and it's the occasion of her new memoir, or book of memories, Things I've Been Silent About. She's the author, most of you will know, of Reading Lolita in Tehran, which was really a magnificent book for me because, well, many of us have found it difficult to reframe the arguments for why we read, mm-hmm. for why culture is valuable. And they're so deep dyed in our nature that you lose the words for the value. The value has always been assumed, given.
Yeah.
And so when you read a book like this in which literature is put into the frame of life in post-revolution Iran and needs to be defended, not just against authority, but explained to readers, why are we reading these books in which adultery, in which all kinds of dark events are taking place? What is it that literature is? Now, in this new book, Things I've Been Silent About, you're doing the opposite. These are people who in life have dealt with adultery, with lies. We're experiencing these characters modified by your memory, but unmodified by the transforming powers of fiction. What was it like to strip your parents down of the stories that you've told about them, of the things that you know, and tell the truth about them?
It was very, very painful, and it was a process that was dominated by doubt, by the pain of the love I felt for them. And yet, when you love someone, I remember, I think I mentioned in this book, I had a philosophy teacher who used to tell me, if you want to know you love someone, the test for it is if you love their dirty socks. The whole idea being that you love someone not because they're perfect or that you present a perfect image of them to the world. You love them despite their problems, their faults, their weaknesses. Discovering their vulnerabilities with the distance that writing brings made me understand them, and it modified the bitterness.
Do you, in the course of writing them, writing about them, did they become literary characters for you, or did they stay real?
There were two levels, because I remember times when I would start writing, especially about my father, and I would start crying, you know, and I would write and cry, and because they became so vivid. Sometimes more vivid than maybe in actual life. But at the same time, narrative is narrative. As soon as you take the pen to paper, you yourself become a character. And you need to have that narrative distance in order to go into the mind of even people who are your parents. And so they became characters once I started writing about them.
As a critic, you began your interest in literature with the Proletarian novel, Mike Gold, Jews Without Money, novels of this kind, who came and supplanted for a period the Hemingway and Fitzgerald ethos. It seems to me that that bottom line understanding of life as being the result of pressures, economic mm-hmm. and political, is very much at the heart of the way you understand your parents.
Yes, but, you know, before Mike Gold, of course, I loved literature. And to tell you the truth, all through the period when I myself was very ideologically and politically involved, I would still be reading my Jane Austen and Great Gatsby. That was one of the contradictions of my life. I couldn't leave those books behind. But I wanted to understand the proletarian literature because that was the ideology that I was drawn to. And
I'm thinking that the revelation of your parents' life mm-hmm. as being dependent upon money, lies, the structure mm-hmm. of a society that is requiring yeah. a certain kind yeah. of evasion.
Yeah, coming from. Well, you know, the interesting thing about my parents was that I think I mentioned it in the book, but that is how I feel about them, that they both were constantly searching for structure and for home, and simultaneously they were very homeless. They always wanted to be part of the social structure, but as soon as they became part of it, when my father became mayor, my mother became member of parliament, they started breaking it. They became outrageous, they broke the rules, and they became outsiders. That was very hard when I was young, and it was very hard on them. I now appreciate it because what Hannah Arendt talks about, a writer or an intellectual should be always outside the outsider's viewpoint. They naturally brought that to our home.
Now, at the same time, what you're doing, you say, is revealing things that could not be revealed in Iran, where mm. personal disclosure yeah. is frowned upon, not quite forbidden, but not mm. not natural, yeah. not the rule.
Well, you know, of course, during the Islamic Republic, this was taken to the extremes because not just the articulation of personal desires and emotions, but just manifesting them in your everyday life, even the way you dressed or holding hand with someone you loved, all of this became against the law. People constantly defy it, you know, every day because it goes against their nature.
Now, your mother, who appears in Reading Lolita in Tehran, takes on a whole new alternative aspect in this book. She is tyrannical and simultaneously self-pitying. Mm-hmm. She exists in what feels a good deal of the time like a fugue state, in which she is singing an aria about a life, a previous marriage, when in fact the man she'd been married to briefly knew he was dying, didn't tell her, yeah. married her anyway, but she has spun a huge yeah. mythology about being married to the son of the prime minister, about yeah. the deathless love yeah. he had for her. And I wondered what it was like first to live with someone who had become yeah. so repetitious.
No, it was in one sense horrendous. What I talk about in Reading Lolita, the coffee sessions she loved making, there were rare moments when she was the woman that she could have been, carefree and lovely. These were during her coffee sessions with her friends or walking down the streets of Tehran, going to chocolate shop or a spice shop. But what do you say? At first, during my early childhood, I just felt guilty. I didn't know what it was that she wanted of us, because it seemed as if no matter what we did, we always fell short, because that past, as you mentioned, singing an aria to the past, was so glorious that nothing my father could do. And he tried. he tried hard, could match something that is frozen and something that is in someone's imagination and not real. You can't compete with the imagination. You can compete with the real man. Had this guy been alive, he would commit things. But now he was beyond pale, you know.
Yeah, in certain ways, she has some of the aspect, or you represent her as having the aspect of Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard.
Yes, it is both destruction and self-destruction. What made her poignant, and I guess actually it makes Gloria Swanson poignant as well in Sunset Boulevard, was her amazing need for love. And one reason that for me it became important to write about it was because I saw how devastating it is when you cannot articulate yourself to others. Because you need to be who you are, and then you need to renew that self through connecting to other people and expressing yourself. She couldn't express herself. It always stayed like a lump in her throat. My father wasn't that way. So in a sense, he escaped to a degree. He escaped.
Now, but he was a storyteller and to some extent the victim of her stories. He introduces you to Iranian literature by telling aspects of epics and sagas as fairy stories and introduces you to the idea of strong women. At some times, did your mother, in her indomitability, strike you as being like one of the strong women of the epics?
Well, you know, she was in many senses very strong. First of all, she was very strong-willed, and she could deny herself many things when she went after something. She wanted me to learn English, and she didn't know how to speak English. She knew French. Every night she would take my book to my aunt who spoke English and learn each page in English to come home and teach it to me. And she came and stayed with me in England for 3 months looking up the dictionary in order for me to go ahead. So she was very strong-willed. And I mentioned in the book that her best friend used to say, another intelligent woman gone to waste.
By the way, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Azar Nafisi, the author of Things I've Been Silent About, published by Random House. I'm talking to Azar about her mother right now, and we'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Azar Nafisi about her memoir, Things I've Been Silent About. You seem to be very strong in your knowledge that one of the things that literature does is to present things in their imperfections, that we are not reading about Humbert Humbert's violation of a 12-year-old. We're reading about how the totalitarian imagination, the controlling imagination, makes the world its prey. Do you feel that recognizing the imperfections of your parents helped you to accept the imperfections of characters in literature?
Oh, definitely, and vice versa. because I think I learned from literature. I mentioned Jane Austen in reading Lolita in Tehran. That is what is a democratic imagination, is all about. That you have to go into the mind of each character, even the villain. Even the villain has the right to speak, and there is something there that might be redeemable. And so living in the Islamic Republic, where nothing seemed to be redeemable, that did not fill in the formula, I realized that I should actually use the novelistic technique. And I, using that, I think I loved my parents more, but also I loved myself more, you know, because I, having lied as a child to my mother, made me ashamed of myself as well, you know, and at some point I feel that we redeem ourselves through fiction. That is where you need to go.
One of the most striking things about reading Lolita in Tehran is that, in a sense, while Gatsby in the novel never goes on trial, mm-hmm. he might have been about to, but he's found dead in his
yes.
swimming pool. You conduct with your students the trial of the novel, The Great Gatsby, very dramatically. And you liken the novels of Jane Austen to a dance. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, were there forms that helped you to imagine the things you talk about and things I've been silent about?
You mean in the way I used the trial in Gatsby? Yes, because, well, first of all, that student who started my thinking about the trial in Gatsby, I felt that he's looking at imagination like an interrogator. And when you look at something as an interrogator, obviously you cannot see what is in front of you, you know. And through the novelistic imagination, which I really feel is an attitude towards life, I was able to see my parents. Because when I was confronted with my mother, and when she would ask unreasonable things of me, I would become so blind with bitterness that I would not see this woman in her loneliness, isolation, that how much, despite of what she didn't have, how much she gave me. But looking at her now, I realize and I empathize. So despite the fact that she comes out through most of this book as tyrannical, by the end of the book, we see a person with whom we empathize, you know, and try to understand.
Well, I think it is the thing that we learn from Flaubert, that on a certain level, mm-hmm. the writer must be merciless.
Yes.
And yet be aware that in life we are prey to the dreams that come to us from sentimental impulses, from repeating the same story too
yeah.
much, from projecting into not necessarily very good fiction. And by the end of Madame Bovary, we realize we've been watching a process of tender mercilessness.
Yes. Yes, of course, Madame Bovary is also amazing. I don't know. I think I mentioned it. Anyway, I had written about it. I might have cut it out of this book. But my mother, who shunned adultery, so, you know, inflexibly, I felt she had a lot in common with Madame Bovary, in the sense that Emma Bovary imposes her romantic vision of married life, of the kind of love that she wants, on real life. And she self-destructs, and the world around her, you know, is destroyed. But her husband, Charles Bovary, also makes an idol out of Emma and becomes blind to reality, and he pays for it. Novel teaches us a great deal about the high price we pay when we become blind. I mean, blindness is very central.
That's so interesting, because what I'm understanding is that the Islamic view of women is also a romantic vision.
Well, you know, that the whole
punishing one, but
yeah. But you know, the whole idea is, that is why both in reading Lolita and in this book, I wanted to show how many different interpretations of religion there can be, because also Hafiz or Rumi, who wrote, Rumi was a Sufi, and Sufis in Iran right now are being persecuted and their places of worship destroyed. they are so erotic. And their metaphor for God is the image of a beloved. And their metaphor for communion with God is wine, you know. But this Orthodox Islam, in order to justify its lack of compassion for women, the laws against women, then idolizes them and says that this is for your own protection, you know.
Now tell me, because, you know, in America now, we are suffering through a time where people, it is said, are not reading or buying our best novels.
Yes.
Do you think, do you still have the faith that Nabokov has, that what lasts is genius and that we will live beyond this sliding?
Yeah.
Of the beautiful and brilliant?
Well, I tell you what I believe, because this is one of the most, one of the sources of great anguish to me about this country that was based on a poetic vision. I mean, we're evoking Lincoln and Martin Luther King and the founding fathers. My God, you know, the resonances of Shakespeare and Bible through these people did not just go and do something politically. They had a poetic vision and they had an imaginative knowledge of their time, you know, that no politician today can really claim. I think what I believe is would Bellow, and I think Nabokov would agree, that a culture who has lost its love of its poetry and its soul is a culture that is facing death. I don't believe any nation can sustain greatness and develop and progress without sustaining a constantly changing poetic imagination. That is why we should take this seriously.
I agree. Now, it sounds as if in things I've been silent about by my guest, Azar Nafisi, in order to sustain a poetic vision, you have to be willing to go through the process of close looking and of extirpating the things that are hard to love by naming them specifically, by being accurate. And the book seems to be about, whereas reading Lolita in Tehran is a shapely book, this book seems to be about ripping the seams and seeing what's hidden inside the mattress, that it must not allow itself the consolation of fictionalizing.
You're right, because as Hegel would say, form is content and content is form. They each shape one another. And in this book, I had to follow the dictates of those emotions and feelings that were leaping out. And it is very different from reading Lolita. And as you mentioned, I like that adjective you're using. It's a shapely book. It is deliberately structured around
Has refrains. And in fact, that book says, let us imagine.
Yeah.
Its paragraphs repeatedly begin, let us imagine. Here, we're not being asked to imagine. We're being shown. We're being shown, and we're being shown things that the people would not be willing to own. I think these parents would, seeing this book, say to their friends, she's telling lies.
You're right, and a lot of people would say, how could she?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people would say that. I had to risk that because otherwise I wouldn't be able to write. You can't fake, you know, writing is like making love. You can't fake it. You have to do what you have to do. And to be honest with you, I thought about that. I thought about all the things that people will say about me and about my family, and that I will be exposing myself to something that I can never retract. But then what else could I do, you know?
Now, I think in the course of things I've been silent about, we see that the author, Azara Nafisi, is very much like both of her parents.
Yeah.
She is strong-willed.
You're right.
She won't compromise when compromise might be easier. And in this, she's like her mother. And she is an understander of the consolations and felicities of inventing stories when they will, in some sense, solve problems. So she becomes a somewhat complacent confederate of her father in his lies.
Yeah.
And I thought, isn't it interesting? There's like a djinn or a genie that rises from this novel and points a finger at the author, says, you are not free of the faults that you find in others. And that seems to me is very true. The humanity of writing.
I hate to use this word because it has been so become such a cliche, but one is very much humbled, because in real life, I mean, with reading Lolita, I felt all this hatred and resentment. But once I started writing, I found the vulnerabilities in the people I so much opposed, you know. In this book, it was different. It wasn't about other people. It was about, and I mentioned that I was responding to my own inner inquisitor and inner censor. I had to look at me, and looking at myself and seeing that I have lived with myself for a long time with these faults, surely I can live with others who have the same kind of faults or different kind of faults.
I've been talking with Azara Nafisi, author most recently of Things I've Been Silent About, published by Random House. Thank you, Azara, for joining me.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Michael.
You can read an excerpt from Things I've Been Silent About at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. Nights were bold in books, 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 books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.